Welcome to the February edition of ASAP Nowcast. The magazine this month has a lot of articles that I hope you'll enjoy reading. One, we talk about ABIM certification with ABIM President Marion Gauchy Hill. You can see a little bit more of that discussion online on ASAP's YouTube channel. We also go in depth with Dr. Paul Kozak about the wide world of sports and his experience working in the Phoenix Raceway. We also have a look at the crisis in emergency department challenges during this pandemic, especially as it deals with staffing physicians, staffing nurses. But we're going to start this podcast with an in-depth look at an article I found fairly interesting, one about the link between urinary tract infections and estrogen in postmenopausal women. So let's get into that episode, and I'll be back afterwards with a recap of the rest of the February issue of ASAP Now. All right, everybody, thank you and welcome back to ASAP Now for the February 2022 edition. With me today, we have Dr. Ashley Winter and Dr. Rachel Rubin. They wrote a great article in our February issue of ASAP Now. They are both renowned urologists focusing on sexual medicine, and they joined up with emergency physician Dr. Howie Mell to make this article after they had an interesting conversation that was sparked on Twitter by something that Dr. Winter sent out, which I would say kind of struck me as a little interesting and bold. She said, "I've eliminated more UTIs from this planet with vaginal estradiol than with antibiotics." I remember seeing that tweet and I was like, that makes absolutely no sense to me. But apparently it's a thing. So welcome Drs. Winter and Dr. Rubin.
Yeah, we're so honored to be here and we're so excited about it too.
Thank you for having us.
All right, well, first thing, I got to start with this because I remember the article came to me. You guys handed it to me. I looked at it and I started reading the first paragraph. If you haven't read it yet, read it. But I needed some clarification because, like, one of the first lines was like, we're talking about patients with vulvas. And I'm like, who do they mean patients with vulvas? Who exactly are we talking about in this particular situation?
Well, recurrent urinary tract infections can occur in many types of humans. You can see it in breastfeeding women. You can see it in transgender men. You can see it in postmenopausal women and certainly premenopausal women. And so many different things can cause recurrent urinary tract infections. But one of the big drivers is the lack of hormones. When you have no hormones in your body, the vulva tissue, the vaginal tissue, the bladder, the urethra become thin and raw and irritated. That loses the acidity to fight infection, and you get urinary tract infections. And so there are a number of different states that can lead to a low hormone states that can lead to, you know, urinary tract infections, which is what Dr. Winter was alluding to in her amazing tweet. And by giving back local vaginal estrogen to these populations, you can potentially stop recurrent urinary tract infections.
It came out basically of the spur of the moment, right? Like, I was in my clinic, I practiced urology, and, you know, I was probably seeing my, 10,000th patient for recurrent UTIs, right? And there are certain cases where it's, you know, vaginal estrogen is not going to do the deal, right? I mean, maybe somebody has, a large burden of kidney stones, maybe they're experiencing urinary retention, and that's the cause of their urinary tract infection. But overwhelmingly, there was just a huge population of patients that were coming in for recurrent UTIs who were in a state of having a hormone deficient vulva, which again is the gateway to the urinary tract, right? In those patients. I mean, that's where your urethra enters. And what I realized was that I was it had taken so many lines of providers seeing them until they got to urology, but oftentimes I was the first person to raise the issue of vaginal estrogen, or they had been prescribed it, but they didn't understand how to use it or why it was important or what the risks were. And again and again and again and again, I was the person prescribing that. And again and again and again and again, people in that state of having a hormone deficient vulva, as Rachel said, you know, postmenopausal women, for example, as one example amongst many, and those patients have a dramatic decrease in their infections. And so more so than, people being on prophylactic antibiotics, people receiving that treatment to correct the hormone deficiency and reestablish this kind of protective milieu with acidification of the vagina was preventing urinary tract infections. And I had patients who'd been like walking around in complete abject misery for like a decade and had been on prophylactic antibiotics, UTI, sometimes even pyelonephritis and emergency room visits. And then, you know, we get them on their vaginal estrogen consistently and the problem is gone or dramatically reduced. And it's just so powerful a difference and so dramatic a difference and so effective of the vast majority of the time. And I just felt so passionately that like everybody needs to distill this in their brain.
It was very much a very bold statement. And I'll say, as one of those people, like we sometimes see these folks that come in and over again, it's like, I have another UTI. I have another UTI. I have another UTI. And we're like, fine, let's draw the UA. And then it comes back like nothing. And then we're like, well, what do we do? Because now they're in the ER in the middle of the night and they've been waiting for 3, 4, 5 hours in the waiting room. And they're going to be super pissed if we don't do something for them. And I think it's just so easy for us as emergency physicians to just say, you know what? Well, your symptoms sound like a UTI again. Let's go ahead and just throw more antibiotics at it. So when I saw this, I was like, wait a minute. We have a new treatment. We have something else we can do. So I thought that was pretty amazing. And, you know, you guys mentioned, you know, choosing wisely, which I love to mention all the time because we in medicine tend to do so much more than we really should. No antibiotics if people don't have symptoms and no cultures if people don't have symptoms. You know, stuff that we need to stop doing. But this is something that we can start doing, as you said, for what's called genitourinary syndrome of menopause. So can you tell us a little bit more about it? You explained some of it already, Dr. Winter. Dr. Rubin, is there anything else that the emergency physician should know? Or maybe even, let's just say, the regular primary care physician, because I think this would be helpful to them as well. What should they be doing to help diagnose this condition?
Yeah, this is absolutely in the wheelhouse of every primary care provider, every emergency room physician. They can do this and they should be doing this. And just because you haven't done it before doesn't mean you can't learn new things. Y'all learn new things all the time. So, past menopause, let's say over 50, just to be broad here, the ovaries are no longer producing estrogen and androgens and the tissue is very hormonally sensitive. Think a baby vulva has no labia minora. It's red, it's raw, it's irritated. You can't put a tampon in there. Then puberty happens. You get a surge of hormones. The tissue grows and changes. You grow labia minora. You get pink tissue that lubricates that you can have penetration. You know, bowling ball children, headed children can come out of there. It is hormonally sensitive tissue. So then after 50, you lose those hormones again. And so the tissue becomes deplete. All those receptors kind of become deplete. And so it gets thin. It gets raw, it gets irritated, it loses the acidity to fight infection, and now sex becomes painful, vaginal dryness happens, and there's a lot of sexual dysfunction that occurs, which is very important. Dr. Winter and I are both sex doctors, we care very much about that. But on beyond that, genitourinary syndrome of menopause has a host of urinary issues. So urinary frequency, urinary urgency, and recurrent urinary tract infections, which is where the emergency room doctors really play a role. So how many times, Dr. Dark, do you see that nursing home patient who's 90 who comes in with mental status changes and has a positive UA? Well, if she had vaginal estrogen on board, she may not have to come in again. And so genitourinary syndrome of menopause is basically what the symptoms are when the tissue is depleted of hormones. So it takes about 2 months to rebuild with the use of vaginal hormones. They're totally safe even for 98-year-old patients, but it takes about 2 months to start working, but it will only work if they keep using them. Just like you tell your patients, you got to wear your seatbelt every time. You got to wear your helmet every time you get on that motorcycle. You have to keep using vaginal estrogen in order for it to keep working, to keep your tissue strong and healthy.
And the urologic associations have a guideline on this as well, correct?
We're working on that. Actually, I just had a meeting a little earlier today to try. They have a guideline for recurrent urinary tract infections, not specifically to GSM, but in their guidelines for recurrent UTIs, it says that every peri and postmenopausal woman with recurrent urinary tract infection should be on vaginal estrogen unless there is a contraindication. And I can argue with a whole lot of data that there is almost no person who has a true contraindication to these therapies.
I just wanted to jump in with two comments. So one, there's a dual benefit, for the emergency physician you know, having this tool in their toolbox, right? So A, that they can reduce the risk, you know, the risk of urinary tract infections. They can reduce the episodes of people coming to the emergency room or the urgent care with these symptoms. They can reduce the risk of hospitalization for pyelonephritis in these patients. But conversely, like you're saying, when they come in with UTI-like symptoms and don't have an infection, you actually have an evidence-based therapy and a diagnosis and an answer for what their symptoms are, right? Instead of giving them antibiotics that are not indicated. So you're doing two things, right, that are amazing. And then the other thing I just wanted to comment on, why I think this is so enactable in an emergency format, is the fact that it does not require blood level monitoring, right? And because it is so safe, as Dr. Rubin mentioned, you know, this is the sort of thing that they can take it and they can run with it. And of course, their PCP will need to start prescribing it, but there's not a risk that they're going to go off from your emergency room with a dangerous therapy that is not monitored, right? Like, nobody overdosed on vaginal estrogen and died from it. Like, that's never going to happen, right? So it's so safe and it doesn't require monitoring. So this is in the toolbox to get them started, give them some educational handout information that they can bring to their, you know, primary care physician who can continue their prescription. So
who may not know what GSM is, right? That's the tragedy here, is many gynecologists don't even know that this is first line therapy and should be, which is why you hear Dr. Winter and I yelling so loudly on social media, because we are single-handedly trying to change the conversation, because nobody realizes the urinary effects of this condition. It's always about dryness and pain with sex, which patients don't complain of because they don't think the doctors want to hear about it, which they don't, because no one teaches us sexual medicine in our medical schools.
And we don't ask.
And also for those patients who think, oh, I don't need vaginal estrogen because I'm not sexually active, for example, right? It's like, that doesn't matter. It's part of your quality of life. It's part of, you know, urgency, frequency, risk reduction. This is basic quality of life. You know, it is not about sex. So it's about sex, but it's also not about sex.
I had a patient just today who is a veteran who has breast cancer. She's on Arimidex and she can't walk without pain, right? Wiping herself is painful. She has constipation because her pelvic floor muscles are so tight because the tissue on top of them is so irritated and raw. So the muscles underneath tighten up. So you get constipation, pain with wiping, pain with just walking, I have patients who can't wear pants. I had one patient who said, oh my God, Dr. Rubin, it's about wearing pants again. I didn't realize it was about wearing pants.
Yeah. What the lack of hormones does, right, is it creates a milieu where you almost feel like you have a herpes ulcer on the opening of your urethra all the time, right? Like, that's what some of these people feel like. That sucks.
Yeah, that sounds pretty bad. But let me ask you this, because you mentioned, like, the patient with breast cancer. You know, always when we're talking about estrogens in our minds as emergency doctors, we're thinking, oh man, we're going to give somebody a blood clot. So risk benefits. You said that there was almost no one that would have a true contraindication for this, Dr. Rubin. Can you give me just a little bit about risks and benefits and what we should know as to why this is safe for us to start in the ER?
I'll be super quick. You know, so if we draw your blood right now, Dr. Dark, your estrogen is 25. Mine is probably between 50 to 300 picograms per milliliter. When I was pregnant, it was about 3,000, right? When you give a woman a birth control pill, it is like crazy high levels of synthetic estradiol, and those women can get blood clots. And certainly you see that in your emergency room. Local vaginal estradiol, a 10 microgram tablet or a 0.01% gel, doesn't increase blood levels in any discernible way. There have been studies. There is no increase in systemic estrogen absorption. So tell me how you're going to get blood clots. The blood clots happen because of oral synthetic estradiol goes through the liver and it pumps out all these clotting factors. And so that's where the blood clots come from. That, where the WHI came out in 2003, was the source of those blood clots and cardiovascular risk, was the oral synthetic hormone that went through the liver and pumped out clotting protein. estrogens are not all the same, right? That's so wild. Like a vaginal gel or a vaginal tablet is not the same as a birth control pill. An IUD doesn't have the same risk profile as a condom, even though they're both contraception. So we have to get over the idea that all estrogen is dangerous. We don't take away all men's testosterones with localized prostate cancer, right? It's a nuanced thing. Whereas if they have metastatic prostate cancer, you do androgen deprivation therapy at that point. So we have to get comfortable that hormones have nuance and they're not all the same. So there's no risk of blood clots at all with vaginal estrogen. That has been proven. There is no long-term risk in people who have had endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, breast cancer, for that matter. It's been proven. Within the guidelines, they do recommend if you have a patient with breast cancer, just like the one I spoke about, talk to their oncologist. So maybe in the ER, you're not going to start that person on, you know, but for my practice, you know, I talk to the oncologist and I say, hey, is this fine? And ASCO has come out with guidelines that say, you know, with shared decision making, we have no data to show harm. It's this theoretical idea, but there's not a piece of data to actually show harm. And but I have a ton of data to show GSM causes depression. It causes pelvic pain, which, you know, opiate abuse can happen, recurrent urinary tract infections, which can kill you, right? In your hospital, how many women have a catheter associated urinary tract infections that your hospital is always trying to decrease, right? How many of those patients could we reduce if they were on vaginal estrogen?
I'll say my hospital is zero because we don't inappropriately put in catheters ever, period. You know, because we're a perfect hospital. But okay, so Dr. Winter, let me ask you this. So patient comes in, I think they have GSM and they have these recurrent UTI symptoms. We check the urine. It looks fine. I'm okay. Like now in my mind, I'm going to go ahead and do some form of estrogen replacement therapy here. Do I just sit around, write a script for 3 months and send them off to follow up with a urologist, follow up with their PCP, gynecologist, family, internal medicine? Like, what do I do? How long do I prescribe this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would generally say their primary care. You know, certainly if you have a relationship in the community with somebody, you know, that's great and you can send it them to. But yeah, I mean, I think the primary care, honestly. I mean, you know, like I said, it's something that if they're already seeing their primary care, this is something that does not require blood monitoring. You know, it's not a controlled substance. It's super easy to do. And whatever's going to get them to the point where they're, you know, actually getting that prescription filled and using it, that's going to have the most benefit. It really does not need specialist level attention to prescribe. So yeah. And I think, you know, within your hospital system, having like, you know, if there's on your EHR, you know, like a little drop down box that your hospital can generate with like some different options, right? Like, is it a 0.01% estradiol cream? Do you want to do the low dose vaginal estrogen tablet and just give like a few options, you know, where your providers can just like type in GSM and that will pop up, right? Then that will lead to so much more compliance. And associated with that pop-up, maybe there can be a patient education like handout, right? Like, I'm sure you guys have an automated handout, like if somebody is being discharged from the emergency room with a kidney stone and there's kind of like an automatic thing that pops up, like, this is about your kidney stone, right? Like, you can do that about the vaginal estrogen.
A plug for Texas, because Mark Cuban's new online pharmacy has $10 a month vaginal estrogen tablets and $50 tubes of cream, which lasts several months. So now, as of last week, we now have the ability to give this a reasonable cost to patients, which we did not have until a week ago. So a big high fives to Texas entrepreneurs.
Yeah, we'll have to make sure Mark Cuban listens to this podcast.
He liked my tweet.
There you go.
And one other just, you know, comment on education and risk. So all of these prescriptions still do come with a black box warning that contains the WHI data. Okay. So it's really important that we all as providers know that so that we can tell the patients to expect that. And that the data in the black box warning, as Dr. Rubin was saying, is predicated on systemic hormone replacement therapy, right? It's not based on the local treatments, and that there has been multiple attempts by ACOG and other, you know, physician organizations to have the FDA remove that black box warning. They have specifically requested it on multiple occasions. and it has not been granted by the FDA. So it's important for patients to know that, because otherwise you will do this amazing counseling and they will still get that black box warning and they will freak out and they won't take it. So it is really important for them to know that. And it's really important for all of us to know that too. Like, sometimes the package insert sucks, and this is one of those times.
Well, I mean, we are a group of physicians that really likes to look at black box warnings and turn our head the other way and do what's right for the patient. So, that's what we are in emergency medicine. We practice a little bit at the edge sometimes if we have to get the job done. So thank you guys so much for, one, educating me on this topic, because it's something I had never heard of before, and I think this is going to change the paradigm of how we treat certain patients that come in with these recurrent, seemingly untreatable symptoms prior. So I think that's going to be extremely helpful. For those of you listening, if you haven't read the article yet in the February issue of the magazine, there's a great little table which talks about creams, inserts, and vaginal rings with all the different prescribing information that you might need to get started with this. And then I guess the last thing I want to ask you about, and I got to thank Dr. Mel for initiating this. What do you guys think about Twitter for collaboration, this interspecialty collaboration, and you know, for educating our colleagues? Because, you know, in the hospital, I'm stuck usually down on the ground floor somewhere. Every once in a while, you know, someone from upstairs will come in and see the patient in the ER. And of course, I always use that opportunity to ask a question, to learn something from them. What can we do as, you know, med Twitter to educate each other? And I think right now on this one, we're going to need to make sure that we talk to our primary care docs, because I could see this as a potential barrier for continuing this therapy. Because again, I'm only going to prescribe it for maybe a month or a couple months, and I really need primary care to kick in.
It's so important, outlets like Twitter. I mean, we are all way too busy when we are, like, when you are in the emergency room, you are way too busy all the time, right? You are so busy. And all of us are so busy, and we are getting by, and we are spending all our minutes either surviving or peeing or giving patient care or documenting, right?
You guys get to pee? We don't get to pee.
I pee a lot. That's why I became a urologist, I think, so I would be less ashamed of myself. So you guys aren't peeing. But the point being, our level of busyness, I think, so often takes away some of what the aspirational aspects of medicine, which includes being excited about the topics that we care for, about information sharing, about interdisciplinary collaboration, right? Because as much as we love these things, as much as we love the people that we work with, you know, you and I don't have time when I come down to see the Fournier's guy in Bay A13, you know, to talk about vaginal estrogen and the New England Journal of Medicine article, right? So social media is that great time where you can jump in and out in brief moments and really share the things you're passionate about. And I will say, between Dr. Rubin and I being on this crusade of saying vaginal estrogen again and again and again, so many people reach out to both of us from primary care, from emergency, from GYN, from pharmacists, hospital pharmacists, saying we're getting this on our formulary because we have not shut up about this topic. And that's freaking amazing. So I think anytime anybody in any specialty sees a low-hanging fruit, you know, come to the community and share what you've got, because people aren't opposed to information sharing and all, like, raising up our practices together, right? It's not, yeah. So that's my very long answer.
All right, Dr. Rubin, do you have anything to say on that? Twitter for collaboration.
I think we didn't learn anything about sexual medicine in our medical schools. And the word vulva and vagina no one can even use the word vulva, right? Even they call it a vagina. So we're not even getting the anatomy correct when we're talking about it. And they're private parts, right? We examine women using a sheet like we're mechanics so that they feel comfortable, so they can't see what we're looking at. You know, we feel awkward being down there. We're trying to keep them comfortable when really we're telling them these are private parts. These are dirty. We don't really want to talk about them or to teach you what we see here. And so we don't feel comfortable talking about vulvar conditions. And so patients don't bring it up with us. They don't even know that there are medical treatments available. And women's sexual health often has no value in our society, which we could get into a long conversation about. But really, this is not just about sexual health. But giving vaginal estrogen will improve sexual health that the level of Viagra does in terms of bringing back arousal, lubrication, and much sexual interest. Even orgasm will improve in all of these patients. But we don't want to talk talk about that. What we do want to talk about is it will decrease hospital dollars on UTI treatments. It will decrease death. It will decrease, there's even one paper to show a decrease in cardiovascular disease, which we could get into another time. But these women can walk, they can wear pants, they can wipe again, they don't have frequency. They won't break their hips because they're not waking up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and then fall. It's just so important, but it just nobody realizes it. And nobody wants to say the word vagina. Dr. Winter and I will happily say the word vagina, and we will talk about it frequently to get everyone else comfortable saying it too.
Now, if you can get the orthopods to start saying it, then I will say that you have...
Challenge, hold my beer. Hold my beer. Challenge accepted.
No, listen to this. If the postmenopausal patients who need their hips replaced do not have a UTI before their surgery, they don't get canceled and it doesn't mess with their OR day.
I actually think it should be part of pre-op care. So grandma's going in to get her hip replaced 2 months before, and pre-op, you put her on vaginal estrogen, she will not get a urinary tract infection, which will make you have to talk at M&M and have to tell everyone that, you know, your patient got readmitted with a UTI. So it's going to be an important part, ultimately, of pre-op care as well, in my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you both very much, Dr. Ashley Winter, Dr. Rachel Rubin. And let's also thank Dr. Howie Mell for writing this article with you. This was a great article in the February issue of ASEP Now. Thanks for joining me on ASEP Nowcast. It's time for ASEP to consider committee applicants. ASEP has 30 different committees working to support emergency physicians and advance the specialty, encompassing many areas of clinical care, physician wellness, advocacy, EMS, practice management, research, compensation, and much more. So if you're interested applying for one of the committees, visit asep.org/committee-applicants for more information. Applications are due May 15th, 2022. Thanks so much for listening to the February issue of ASEP Nowcast. A few things to look for in the magazine this month. We talk about echocardiography for hemodynamic optimization in people with RV dysfunction. We talk about how to evaluate spontaneous cervical artery dissection. We'll get a mention of ASEP as they sue the federal government over the implementation of the No Surprises Act. And you'll learn a little bit about the benefits of using the pericapsular nerve group block. So that and many more articles are in the February issue of ASEP Now. I'll see you next time in March.
ASEP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASEP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano. Thanks for listening.